now in, at the Northeast Center to move towards providing information that could form the basis for some of your deliberations in terms of moving towards an ecosystem approach to fishery management. My last presentation to the council, I had the opportunity to tell you a little bit about the background information and the range of ecosystem-oriented research activities that we have ongoing at the center. I won't repeat that information. I have brought some of the booklets that we prepared to try to set the stage, the background information, on the basic considerations from an ecosystem perspective of moving towards a more holistic approach to fishery management. What I would like to tell you about today is some of the work we're doing towards trying to define ecological subunits on the Northeast Continental Shelf that could, should you so choose, provide the basis, at least for the starting point of discussions about management units, because you'll see in a moment that very fundamentally at the heart of an ecosystem approach to fisheries management rests the idea that it's an area-based concept. So Karen, can I please have the next? So in terms of defining the ecosystem, there are a couple of main points that really come immediately out to you from this definition that's been adopted by NOAA in 2004. The first is that we're clearly considering humans to be an integral part of the ecosystem, and we really want to move towards a fully integrated view of not only the natural ecology but the human ecology of the system and bring that into play. The other thing is that you'll see right in front at the very beginning of the definition, again, emphasizing the fact that an ecosystem is a geographically specified system, and that really sets the stage for a lot of what I want to talk about this afternoon. Next, please, Karen. So as you know, there have been a number of recent declarations from a number of sources providing the suggestion that we do move towards a fully integrated ecosystem approach to management in the oceans. The statement that you see before you is from the U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy that you're all familiar with. You know that there are similar statements that have been made by the Pew Commission and other sources. At the international level, Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations is moving very strongly towards an ecosystem approach. But again, in this statement of the need and principles underlying ecosystem management, you'll see that basically, again, humans are a critical part of the ecosystem. And again, you'll see that we're really talking about a geographically specified region. So that's the rationale for moving towards the things that I want to tell you about today, work ongoing at the center. Next, please, Karen. There are a number of very broad statements in terms of principles of ecosystem-based management. This one happens to come from a statement by the Ecological Society of America, again, laying out very generic goals and moving towards an ecosystem approach. And I think none of these are really debatable in terms of the kinds of things we'd like to achieve as we move towards an ecosystem approach. But I think you probably all recognize that the really difficult issue is moving towards the specifics and what we would try to adopt in our own area to meet our own needs. And so part of what I'll turn to at the end of this presentation is an attempt to move towards more specificity in terms of what are the kinds of objectives we might consider as we move towards an ecosystem approach and how might that inform the way we think about structuring things in the activities, the research activities at the center and the considerations the council will have before it. So that's what I'd like to move towards next. One of the critical characteristics or a set of the critical characteristics in this ecosystem approach to management is that we want it to be collaborative, and that's an integral part of moving forward, really trying to forge a consensus on what we want to achieve from an ecosystem perspective. Chad Demarest is going to talk to you after me concerning the sequence of meetings that we had up and down the coast. He'll be talking about the ones that dealt with the New England area, the Northeast area. But really the ideas that would come forward from all the stakeholder groups is really critical. So it does need to be collaborative. It needs to be incremental in the sense that we want to build on existing structures and functions and move towards building on that kind of a perspective. And I'm going to actually show you that more than 30 years ago, we had some elements of a pretty, some very important elements of an ecosystem approach already in place in management. Under the International Commission for Northwest Atlantic Fisheries. It needs to be adaptive and flexible to changing conditions. As I've said a number of times now, it's geographically specific, account for ecosystem knowledge and uncertainty, and I want to tell you a little bit more about the things we think we understand about how the ecosystem on the Northeast Continental Shelf works. and then consider both multiple external factors and balancing diverse societal objectives. Next, please, Karen. In a broad sense, an ecosystem approach to fisheries management is only one part of a much broader issue that we need to consider. So fisheries management is down here, and I think you'll all recognize that as we move towards an ecosystem approach, we need to consider issues that relate to coastal zone management, non-renewable resource development, aquaculture development, and others. So we're dealing with one part, the part that we do have some control over. And in fact, the strongest sorts of ecosystem-type language and legislation currently resides in the fisheries management arena. But ultimately, as you know, we'll need to coordinate across the activities of a broad spectrum of other user groups. But to begin at the top, what we'd like to do is develop a set of ecosystem management objectives. This is where the collaborative and interactive part of the story comes into play in getting ideas on the table about what we'd like to try to achieve, identify critical ecosystem elements, define ocean management areas, and then develop an integrated management plan. So I'm going to talk at the end, actually, about some potential ecosystem management objectives from the fishery perspective, but spend most of my time initially in terms of the ocean management areas. Next, please. To remind you that the background information that a lot of what I'll talk about is based is embodied in this document. I brought some more copies that are out on the bench outside. I know that we do have some new council members may have not seen this, and so I'd like to invite you to take a look at it, try to provide some of the basic and fundamental background information we're drawing on. Next, please. In terms of defining an ecosystem exploitation strategy, what we really need to do is define these regional ecosystem boundaries, determine the fishery production potential within those areas, decide on sustainable exploitation rates that preserve the basic structure and function of the system intact, specify a safe level of total removals from the system, specify allocation strategies for individual species, because I may talk about this from an ecosystem point of view, but we are always going to be interested in cod and haddock and yellowtail and need to keep track of those as well, and we want to fit that into the big picture too. So as I go forward and talk about a higher level of ecological organization, it's with the realization that we are definitely going to have to think about how it fits in when we think about the individual species in the system. And then finally, we have to specify the set of tactical management decisions. And these will include things such as habitat protection and preservation of protected species, in addition to the conservation goals that we'd have for the system and protecting the ecosystem structure and function. So what are some of the potential advantages? I know that there's probably a lot of concern that this only means more regulation, more management, and more complexity in the system. But in fact, we do have the opportunity to simplify and consolidate some of the management regulations. That's one of the issues I'll talk about in this area context in just a moment. We will have ways to explicitly consider environmental or climate change directly in the process. Those kinds of forcing functions are going to be critical thinking about the system from an ecosystem point of view. Dr. Mountain had a chance at the last meeting to tell you about some of the ongoing work and trying to understand the role of climate fluctuations in our area and the productivity of marine resources. And it also gives us a way to consider explicit management trade-offs that we have to consider when, for example, we're harvesting predator-prey groups or groups of competing species and so forth. So it provides a vehicle to bring directly into play a number of important factors in understanding how the system's actually functioning. All right, so the first part I'll take up with you is defining the ecological subregions on the Northeast Continental Shelf as a starting point. And I want to emphasize it's a starting point for the considerations that the Council would have in terms of defining management units. Of course, it is the prerogative of the Council to really decide what the management units would look like. But I do want to tell you about the work that we've been doing at the Center to see if we can define ecologically coherent subunits on the Northeast Continental Shelf. And you will know, I'm sure, that the Northeast Continental Shelf in its entirety has been designated a large marine ecosystem by NOAA based on the work at Ken Sherman at our Narragansett lab. But it's also recognized that there are identifiable differences among some of the areas, and that's really what is sub-areas on the shelf. And what I want to talk about is ways to try to define what those sub-areas might look like, to try to define them in a way that there's a manageable number of them, that it's not a huge number. So we're balancing a number of factors of that type as we go forward. Let me begin by reminding you that, in fact, you're familiar with spatial management units, and we usually think of them as in terms of the stock structure of individual species. So I'll just run through a couple of examples of the stock units that you're currently dealing with. This one happens to be for cod. You can see there's a Gulf of Maine stock, the Georges Bank and South stock. Next, please, Karen. This is Silver Hake, a northern and southern stock. Next, please. This one is for the yellowtail flounder. Again, you know, we've got Cape Cod and Gulf of Maine stock, Georges Bank stock, and southern New England mid-Atlantic stock. Next, please. Sea flax sea bass, which really comprises the inshore areas in the southern part through the mid-Atlantic Bight and up into the southwestern part of the Gulf of Maine. Next, please, Karen. And then on the other extreme, for Atlantic herring, the entire area is designated as a unit stock area. So you're used to seeing a pretty large number of these kinds of geographically specific management considerations that you have to undertake. You'll see from this that actually, and you know from your own experience, that there's actually quite a number of these different stocks. Each one of them, of the stocks that we deal with in the management, both in the New England Council and the Mid-Atlantic Council, often have subtle differences in terms of the boundaries. So there's quite a large number of them. One of the advantages that we might have in going forward with area-based definition is a more of a consolidation of the different management units that we have to a lower number. So what I'd like to describe to you now is the work that we've done trying to find out if there really are similarities that can be defined by a number of basic characteristics in the system, starting all the way down from physiographic considerations in terms of the bathymetry and the sediment types, moving on to a number of these that deal with temperature, including the average sea surface temperature, the range of temperatures we have in different areas, the amount of layering in the water column in the summertime or the stratification, and then they're not starting to get into a number of biological ones, including primary production, which is the amount of plant material that's produced at the very base of the food web that really fuels the whole thing. And for most of them, the continental shelf, we're really talking about microscopic plants, basically, that are the base of this food web. The ratio of how much of this production is at the surface versus how much is below surface. And then a number of factors that relate to overall production or biomass, the weight at different trophic levels or groups of animals, including the zooplankton, which are the tiny drifting animals that form the food for many of the larval fish that we deal with and other species. The biomass of animals on the bottom, the benthic biomass, the fish and shellfish that are in, such as squids, that are in the water column themselves, the number of species that comprise that part of the picture here, what I'll call the species richness, and then a number of specialized considerations that relate to deep water corals, the marine mammals, and sea turtles. So what I'm going to do basically next is to run pretty quickly through a series of maps that show for the entire Northeast Continental Shelf what some of these, the distribution of a lot of these factors look like. And then I'll be giving you some results that come from some statistical analyses to try to pull them together in a way that finds out how much at a given point we have in the way of similarity across all these different considerations. So we're covering quite a broad range of issues, but we want to see if some general patterns emerge. Next, please, Karen. All right, so the first thing that I need to tell you is that in order to go forward with this, we needed to define what I'll refer to as a common spatial frame of reference, because a lot of the information that we're basing this analysis on comes from a pretty broad range of different types of data sets and analyses that are collected on different spatial and temporal scales. So the first thing we did was to deal with this by computing the average within rectangles that are 10 minutes latitude by 10 minutes longitude for each of these variables. So One thing that I want to mention is that we do recognize that these are relatively large areas and that for a lot of the things we might be interested in, we want to delve deeper at finer spatial scales. But the point is that what we really want to do is really get to the big picture for this particular analysis. Now, this data can also be used to look at things on a finer scale, but these areas that are, say, roughly 100 square miles are the basic building blocks that we'll use. So, Karen, next. So the thing that we're trying to do, basically, and if you're sitting far enough away, you'll recognize that this is actually a blocked image of Abraham Lincoln. If you're having trouble seeing it, you can squint a little bit. But the main point is we want to be able to recognize the big pattern just as you can recognize Abraham Lincoln in this image. But we're recognizing that we're blurring over a lot of the fine details. So we want to know that we can identify Abraham Lincoln, but we're not necessarily saying we know how thick his eyebrows are, that kind of thing. Next, please. All right, so the next step really was combine all information using multivariate statistical techniques, and that's the bit I was just telling you about a moment ago. So now I'll step through the basic pictures, and I really won't have time to talk about the individual structures that we're looking at, but I'd be happy to talk about them later. Next, please, Karen. All right, so what I'm going to show you is first the conversion of going from a more detailed spatial representation to this blocked representation. So this is what we start out with in terms of stratification or the layering of the water column. And you see things like it can be, in the summer, can be very strongly stratified. The warmer colors are higher levels of stratification in the Mid-Atlantic Bight. On the center of Georgia, because there's so much tidal energy, it's not stratified at all. Same thing on the Scotian Shelf. Next, please, Karen. This is what that image looks like when we break it down into these blocks that I'm telling you about. And now the next pictures I'm going to show you are all blocked in this way, so you recognize. But the main thing I want you to remember is that underlying these blocked representations is more detailed spatial structure. Next, please, Karen. All right, so this is the bathymetry that you see. The deeper waters are in the warmer colors, shallower in the cooler colors. Next, please. This is the marine sediments. You can see it's mostly sandy on a large part of the shelf, but when you get into the Gulf of Maine, it's very different with a lot of fine sediments. Next, please. This is the sea surface temperature patterns over the entire area, averaged over the entire year. Next, please, Karen. This is the span of temperature. So this is saying warmer colors, higher span. So we've got much more of a range of temperature actually in the Mid-Atlantic region, particularly near shore, than we do, for example, on the central part of Georgia's, which is very different. Next, please. This is the summer stratification index. Next, please. Now primary production. A couple things is that this production of plant material, a couple important things is the warmer colors are higher production. It's really high along the edge of the coastline where there's a lot of nutrients coming in. You'll see it's very high on the central part of Georgia's Bank. And there's some very distinctive differences. For example, it's quite a bit lower in the central part of the Gulf of Maine than it is on Georgia's or the immediate near shore areas of the Gulf of Maine, those kinds of things. All right, now you're looking at zooplankton, and as we get into the biology, it gets messier because that's the way biology is. But these are now the amounts, the warmer colors are higher amounts of zooplankton that we see in the area. It's pretty high in the immediate near shore areas in the Mid-Atlantic and on Georgia's, pretty low in the eastern part of the Gulf of Maine and so on. Next, please. Benthic biomass, these are the animals that live on or in the bottom over time. And again, there are some identifiable patterns. Again, it's pretty low within the deep water basins in the Gulf of Maine. Next, please. This is the fish and squids, what I'll refer to as the necton distribution patterns over the entire area. Next, please, Karen. And this is species richness. So this is of all species, all the animals that are caught in our bottom trawl survey. So in terms of the numbers of species, again, we see some pretty distinctive patterns. In fact, there are, because of some of the smaller invertebrate animals or different types of shellfish that we get in the trawl survey, it's actually quite high in the inner part of the Gulf of Maine. Next, please. All right, so we pulled all that information together and looking for common elements across each of these different data sets. And we do this analysis using something that tries to recognize how similar or not with each one of those cells across all that range, all those range of variables, how much similarity there is within a cell or one of those 10-minute squares compared to the ones all around it. And then we cluster the ones that are similar. And this is the basic pattern that emerges when we do that analysis. We get a section on the western Gulf of Maine coming up up towards the U.S.-Canada border. The eastern Gulf of Maine, and particularly on the Scotian Shelf, is different. George's Bank is very distinctive. The entire Mid-Atlantic Bight near shore is distinctive. And then we've got a very clear pattern right along the edge of the continental shelf that's quite distinctive for a number of different reasons, both in terms of the physiography and also the animals that are there. Now I want to show you, I told you earlier that we held some special species in reserve, what I refer to as the focal species, the corals, the mammals, and turtles. And I want to just overlay the presence or absence from different surveys on the areas that we've identified. So this is for the large whales. This one, you can see that this outer shelf break is an important area for the whales, as are as is the Scotian Shelf and parts, particularly near shore in the Gulf of Maine. Next, please, Karen. This one is for the hard coral species. Again, the outer shelf is very important, and parts in the Scotian Shelf and now the outer part of the western Gulf of Maine. Next, please. And this one is for the sea turtles, where, in fact, for the types of turtles that were surveyed here, the Mid-Atlantic Bight is quite important. So the main point is that there are some very distinctive characteristics that emerge. They're probably actually not all that surprising to you in terms of what you might expect. There are differences in terms of some of the boundaries that we've considered in the past. For example, we have often split out the southern New England area from the Mid-Atlantic bite proper area. This analysis shows this area to be actually pretty coherent throughout. That's not to say there wouldn't be purposes where you might want to split out for management, say, the southern New England from Mid-Atlantic, but that's basically the kind of pattern that emerges. So it's a manageable number that we could consider for developing possibly management units for an ecosystem approach. We'll have to make decisions about whether we want to either split some of them finer or in some cases aggregate them. For example, you may or may not want to have a special area on the slope break here, but rather consider it as a special area. For example, this part of it dealing with the Mid-Atlantic, this part dealing with Georges and so forth. But those are the kinds of decisions and considerations that the council could undertake for that. But the main point is that what we'd like to do then from that background, once we have decided on management units, see what we can understand about the system properties and how we would define an ecosystem approach. So I'm going to show you a couple bits of information from the Georges one just to sort of give an example. So I'll pretend that the council has decided that you wanted to develop a management plan for the Georges Bank region as an entity. Next, please, Karen. So we can decide, once these are defined, we can examine the structure, function, and dynamics of these systems. And I'm just going to show you a couple of examples, but the point that I want to make and the things that I'll show you next is really that when we think about these properties as a system, they're different than what we would think about when we think about the parts of the system. Next, please, Karen. So the first thing, this is from our trawl survey data. A number of different species groups, including the gadids or the cod-like fishes in the yellow, flatfish in green, other groundfish, pelagic fish in the dark blue, principally herring and mackerel, dogfish in the light blue, skates in white, and the total in red. Well, the main message that emerges when you look at this, and let me draw your attention to the fact that to make it easy to get all these things on one scale, these are going up by a factor of 10, going up in this way. But the main message that emerges is that this total is much more stable than the parts. So there are interactions among the parts of the system that make the whole thing more stable. And as you know, particularly if we burrow down more closely, for example, if we were to dissect what goes on with the gadids or the cod-like fishes, you'd know that there's a tremendous amount of variability in haddock that's more variable, in fact, than cod, for example, by comparison, and so on. So at each level that you go down from these different levels of aggregation that I'm showing, you see that there's more underlying variability. One of the advantages, though, of dealing with things at this higher level of ecological organization is that if they're more stable, then they're more predictable, too. And so we could perhaps provide more stable guidance and predictions about what's going on. Next, please, Karen. If we look at a couple of other, and I'm just going to show you after this one more indication of kinds of this sort of stability, this is what we refer to as species diversity, which takes into account not only the average number of species that we're dealing with, but also the relative balance between them. And you can see on George's over time, although it's fluctuated from the information from our trawl surveys, it's actually stayed pretty stable, as has the average number of species that we are dealing with over time, although we actually have had a bit of an increase over the last 10 years or so as more southern species come up onto George's. Next, please, Karen. Or if we look at the aggregate size composition, this happens to come from the fish-eating fish, cod, spiny dogfish, and so forth. And what you're looking at is the average size going across this way, or the size composition, excuse me, going this way, and back in time in five-year blocks of time from 1963 to 67 and moving towards the present in this way. You see that even though, and as you know, we've had some pretty radical fluctuations in terms of, say, the abundance of cod versus the abundance of spiny dogfish, when you look at it from the point of view of the overall size composition in that group, it's actually been relatively stable over time. We did have a period where everything went down in this second block here where the distant water fleets were taking everything. But the main point is that there is actually, when you look at things from this more aggregated level, much more stability overall. Next, please, Karen. All right, so what might some of these things mean in terms of devising an ecosystem-based fishery management strategy? Well, one thing I'd like to point out, as I mentioned right at the very beginning of the talk, is that we actually do have some experience with this kind of thing. And, in fact, before we had established the 200-mile limit, in international waters, which at the time was 12 miles and out, the International Commission for Northwest Atlantic Fisheries was regulating these international fisheries off our shore. And they devised something called the two-tier management system. And basically, what they did was to estimate the total production potential for the entire Northeast Continental Shelf. And they did it using a model that's quite similar, actually, to the ones that are generally applied to single species. You've probably seen millions of these kinds of curves where you've got fishing effort going along the x-axis and the total yield going in the y-axis, and that there's some level where it peaks that gives the maximum sustainable yield. Well, the work that went into defining what the system-wide productivity for the Northeast Continental Shelf involved was actually, instead of taking it one species at a time, it took all the total yields from the species, from all the species, all the fish species, I should say. It didn't include shellfish other than squid, and applied the same sort of model that you've seen for any one of a number of individual species to get to make a determination of the total system maximum sustainable yield, and it was just under a million metric tons is the estimate that they came up with. Now, they were dealing with the early part of the story where the distant water fleets were just coming in and really having a serious impact. Next, please, Karen. So the first step in this was to determine this total system MSY level, and then because, as I mentioned, we recognize that you are always going to be interested in the individual species, there was a next step that was applied, and it said that we wanted to find a way to determine how much we could take of each of the individual species, accounting for bycatch at the same time and making sure that the total doesn't exceed this system-wide MSY. So basically, there then was put in place two steps, one getting this overall production potential for the system and then finding out, given that sort of constraint, how much can we really take from individual species and still not exceed the total? And that's the system that was put into place. And, in fact, some elements of the quota system that was used as a tool for this actually was maintained by the council in the initial years once we established the 200-mile limit. But then by the early 1980s, we went from quota-based management to more qualitative measures. Next, please, Karen. Could I have the next? Oh, thanks. So this is the part of the story in terms of the estimation that they were dealing with is this part of the story. Now, this is the landings for the entire Northeast Continental Shelf over time. When the distant water fleets came in, they began to harvest a lot of things that hadn't really been intensively harvested on Georges. What they didn't take for human food, they took for reduction to go into fertilizer or animal food. But by the time the 200-mile limit came into play, it was clear that, in fact, the distant water fleets had really sequentially over-harvested a number of species, starting with herring and mackerel, going on to haddock, silver hake, and a number of others. So what we've been dealing with since then, to a pretty large degree, is trying to recover from the impact of the distant water fleets. But you can see that although we've had some pretty dramatic fluctuations in terms of the relative species composition overall in terms of the landings, for example, in the red, where you've got what we'll refer to as the principal groundfish, the cod, haddock, flounders, and so forth. The landings have continued to go down slowly over time, but then we've had increases, for example, most dramatically in terms of mollusks such as scallops in this green part of the story up here when we look at the overall relative balances of these things, it's kept things fairly constant. Next, please. All right, so what can we do to try to build on some of the experience that we've had, and what might an objective look like for management? So I want to take this idea of production, and any time you talk about MSY, whether you're talking about it from a single species point of view or from a more holistic ecosystem point of view, you're talking about production. How much can the system produce, and how much of that can be safely harvested by humans? The analysis that I showed you that was done under ICNAF really tried to look exclusively at the fish and saying, well, they're taking into account a lot of the changes and the dynamics at the ecosystem levels below them. But I want to try to see if we can bring it forward right from the very base of the food web as an alternative. Now, let me say that in practice, I think we're going to really want to try a number of different approaches and see whether we converge on the same kinds of answers if we should follow this. But I'm going to propose as one possibility that the council might consider that we would define an optimum yield for ecosystem subregions as a whole, and then we'd have to deal with this issue of, as we did just a moment ago, with allocating across the different species. But if we really begin right at the very base of the food web, this is a picture of this primary production. Now, you've already seen the blocked image of this. This is information that's coming from satellites. The warmer colors are higher primary production, and they're very high as you get into these inner areas, you know, for example, Chesapeake Bay, Delaware Bay, inner Long Island Sound, and so forth, and along the immediate coast. And again, it's high on Georges. But the main thing that we need to keep in mind is that, in fact, it turns out that more primary production means more fish yield. So the areas that are more productive in terms of the very base of the food web tend to have much higher levels of catch. And that can be a pretty important consideration for us as we break this down in our area, because as I said, there are some pretty dramatic differences whether we talk about Georges Bank versus the Gulf of Maine and so on. If I have the next one, Karen, please. All right, so one way to think about this is on a pretty broad scale. If we think about primary production increasing in this direction and fish catch going this direction, I'm showing you two sets of information, one from the North Atlantic and one from the North Pacific. I have no idea why those symbols are like that. They don't look that way on my computer, but that one's a mailbox. That one's a book. Anyways, the main point is that the more primary production, the higher the fish catch you expect in different areas. And, in fact, there are also differences between the Atlantic and the Pacific, as you can see here. This line for the North Atlantic sits above the information. It's higher production than for the North Pacific. Now, even in our area, there are differences. Now, this first book is George's Bank here, circled. Next, please, Karen. This next one is the Mid-Atlantic Bight. Next, please. And this one is the Gulf of Maine. So even in our area, you can see that the differences in the primary production that we can measure also correspond to differences in the average fish catch over a defined period of time in these areas. Next, please, Karen. All right, so one, the very simplest way you could think about this, so if you think about how this energy is going to come up from the base of the food web, the simplest way to start off with is thinking about it as a food chain. So you start off with some of these microscopic plants down here at the base, and there's a lot of them, and they're fueling the zooplankton. This happens to be a copepod, a small crustacean. Pelagic fish next, feeding on piscivorous fish like this bluefish, apex predators like this shark, and, of course, humans. We like to think we're sitting at the top of the heap. But you'll recognize, of course, that that's much too simple, that things just don't work in a simple chain like that. So the work that we've been doing in the center is to try to split things out in terms of a food web in a more coherent way. So next, please, Karen. So what we've done is look at a number of different groups. Now, I don't expect you to be able to read this, particularly from the back of the room, but basically starting down at the bottom of the picture, we have these primary producers, and it's feeding all the way up to finally we come up to the fisheries at the top end. So you'll see these primary producers. You see a number of these zooplankton species here and bottom species here, the shellfish and so forth, going all the way up in this way. Now, our job is to try to connect all these boxes and understand the pattern of energy flow through them. And next, please, Karen. So this, I'm just going to show you a couple of examples because it would get much too complicated, certainly, to put them all on one page. But these are some of the direct pathways between these microscopic plants in different groups, including different copepod groups, for example, all the way through here. These arrows connect these blocks. Now, work that we've been doing at the center has been aimed at trying to, one, identify what these pathways are from, for example, looking both at the information we collect in terms of food habits, and since the early 1970s, we've looked at more than 500,000 fish stomachs, so we have a pretty good idea of what fish eat over time. Some of the information for some parts of this is much more difficult to get, and some of it corresponds to things that we don't actually directly measure all the time at the center. For example, jellyfish, here identified as gelatinous zooplankton. In fact, although we can get some measures of what the changes over time in these jellyfish are, a lot of the sampling tools that we have available to us are not ideally suited for the jellyfish. Next, please, Karen. Bacteria, as it turns out, are quite important in terms of recycling energy. They break down material and then pass it on to others. So we have a box here related to the bacteria, and these are some of the flows that go from the bacteria. A large part of this information comes from other studies by other groups and published in the literature. Next, please. In terms of what I'll refer to as the microzooplankton, or the smallest types of zooplankton, they're feeding other kinds of copepods, small copepods, large copepods, the jellies, and so forth. Next, please. And the small copepods have connections that go all the way from other types of copepods all the way up to the baleen whales, the ones that are straining plankton out of the water column. So you can see it's a big job to try to connect all these dots, but we've been able to do it for the major subareas on the northeast continental shelf through a program that we're calling the Energy Modeling and Analysis Exercise, or EMACS, and we've developed these kinds of pathway models that would then allow us to look at how much energy we actually could expect to get up to the fisheries in the different areas, and then try from that, use that as a basis for trying to go forward with defining what we think is the level of production in the system, and then the kinds of considerations that the council might then take on is what would a safe harvest level from that amount of production be, and how would we do that? How would we deal with that? Next, please. Just one more. Forgot about that. Large copepods here. Again, showing a number of different connections, again, all the way up to the baleen whales. Next, please, Karen. Next. All right. So one part of the story is determining how much is out there, how much is being produced. Another part of the story is going to be, how are we actually going to think about what a safe level of harvest will be? And one of the things that, of course, you've already dealt with in the council is thinking about, for some of the species, such as herring, how much do we need to leave for other species, like the whales or the seabirds? So these are issues you've already been grappling with, tunas and so forth. This is an analysis by Bill Overholtz from our lab about the amount of herring that's been consumed by a couple of dozen different predators, ranging from different fish to marine mammals and seabirds over time. And as the herring have increased, the amount of them that have been consumed, and that's indicated in the red part of this figure, has increased steadily over time. And we can begin to get an idea of what the food requirements are for a number of these important parts of the system by looking at how much has been removed, and also what are some of the other alternative prey that they'd have available to them. Because, for example, if we're talking about whales, they're not only preying on herring, for example, but also on sand lance and a number of other species. So we'd also bring that into play. But this is to give you an idea that, in fact, we have been able to make calculations about how much is eaten of these different groups that are important prey items. And in for contrast here, the landings are stacked on top, and you can see that now certainly the amount that's being consumed by these natural predators is higher than the amount, by a substantial amount, than what the human predators are taking. And this shows you for 1 year amount of the different representation of who's eating what. So, for example, this came from 2002, and mammals were eating 48% of the herring that was consumed during that period, fish 41%, and so on. All right, so these are some of the considerations that would come immediately into play in terms of trying to figure out, once if we took this production potential, we have to think about how much is out there, how much can safely be removed, not only to meet our needs, our fishery needs, but also the needs for other parts of the ecosystem. Other parts that I won't go into today, because I have in previous discussion revolved around the considerations of habitat protection and so forth, issues that Sally was just, are integral, obviously, to the things that Sally was just talking about. In terms of the basic tools that we'd have at our disposal, they're basically similar to the ones that we have available to us from a single species point of view, the kinds of things you're used to thinking about in terms of what you would apply to achieve your objectives from a single species point of view, including controls on effort, different types of conservation engineering, the use of marine protected areas or output controls or TACs. But the point I'd like to make is that we would have very different objectives if we think about it from an ecosystem perspective than we might necessarily from the single species point of view. So I'll use as an example the marine protected area tool. Now, let me say up right from the start that you might sometimes get the impression that ecosystem-based management and marine protected areas are synonymous, and of course they're not. The marine protected areas could be one tool that you would choose to use to meet ecosystem objectives. If you're thinking about them from a single species point of view, you'd be weighing the utility of a marine protected area, for example, in conserving the fish stock or providing yield to the system, and you'd be weighing how effective that might be against other possibilities that you'd have at your disposal, including possibly TACs or different forms of effort limitation and so on. And these are considerations that in one way or another you've already been grappling with. But the main point is then it's a decision about whether you think that the marine protected areas could do better or as well or not as well as some of these other options you have. From an ecosystem point of view, there are more considerations folded into play. It's not only conserving the species we're interested as resource species, but also the considerations that might come into play with habitat protection and so on. And so when you were trying to make a decision about whether, you, in fact, you did want to use marine protected areas as a tool, a thing that you would come immediately to grips with is the set of objectives overall for the system as a whole that you try to come up with. Similarly, you know, if you're dealing with an issue in conservation engineering, from the classical sense, from a single species point of view, you'd be interested in whether you could increase the selectivity of a net for individual species, for example, or a set of species, so that, for example, you're letting small ones go and that sort of thing. From the conservation engineering point of view, you would, in an ecosystem perspective, you'd also obviously be taking on consideration of things about potential impacts or not on the bottom, and the kinds of work that's been done in terms of, for example, sweepless trawls and so forth, come immediately to the fore in trying to determine how you think about the utility of these different pieces of gear and how you might tune them to meet your overall objectives. So I'll leave you with that part. I basically wanted to really set the stage for the next set of considerations that the council might take on. You've identified that you would like to go forward with the development of fishery ecosystem plans or a fishery ecosystem plan. And basically that would entail assembling as much information as possible about the structure and function of the system or parts of the system that we're dealing with that would provide guidance overall to the council in terms of thinking about this overall problem from the perspective of ecosystem-based management. It will be important in the coming year, I think, to begin to think about what objectives we might like to adopt to move towards an ecosystem approach. I do recognize, of course, that until we have explicit language in Magnuson that relate to objectives that relate to ecosystem management, that we are a bit in the dark in terms of what we would what tools we would have at our disposal in terms of a legislative framework and what it would call for. But nonetheless, at the center, what we're trying to do is to assemble the pieces of information that would support you in moving towards the development of a fishery ecosystem plan and trying to anticipate some of the kinds of analyses that might be useful to try to help as we move forward and at least lay out some options that you could consider, accept or reject, or redirect our activities as the set of objectives that you'd like to achieve would come into focus. So thanks very much for your attention. Happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Mike. Any questions? Dave.
Yeah, Mike. It's been a long time, by the way. Third of
Good
a
to
century.
See you again.
Yeah. You're... You're wearing your hair a little shorter than you did back then.
Yeah. Less of it and more gray, I'm afraid.
I'm concerned, or interested rather, intrigued by this 980,000 metric ton total system MSY. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering just how useful that concept is. Particularly, I assume that, is that all quota managed species and nothing else? Or
at the time, it was all quota managed and it was all finfish species. There were no shellfish involved. I think to me, Dave, the important part about it is that back then, now more than 30 years ago, there was a recognition that you've got we need to think about these things as systems rather than the individual parts. And although I think certainly that from a number of different points of view, you'd want to improve the types of considerations that would come into an analysis like that and have more detailed considerations. I think its real value is in sort of setting the stage for the recognition that we are dealing with systems and that the parts of the system interact.
Hmm. Well, you've got so many different species that have so many different there's a homeostasis between all of these species in their population levels. And I'm just curious as to how, when you've got such a difference in MSY among species, how this could be a useful piece of information,
it's sort of trading on this idea that the whole is more stable than the parts. Now, in terms of breaking it down to individual species, the kinds of things that you'd want to bring into play are protections to make sure. You know, basically, if you were to adopt something like this, and again, it's not a recommendation by any means, but it's just an example of what had been done in the past. And many of you may know that in Alaska, a similar kind of thing is currently done for the Bering Sea, where there's a 2 million metric ton cap taken or set for the system. But I guess what I'm trying to say, Dave, is that you can devise a way of it's certainly correct that there are these differences in the MSY levels of the individual species, but this is trying to take into account by proxy almost the fact that because those species interact, you can't, strictly speaking, think about each individual species in isolation. And so you'd want to have the idea is that you'd want to have this overall system specification and then find a way that you would define basically optimum yield for the individual species subject to a set of constraints, including the ones that would say you'd never drive it below some threshold levels, for example, that kind of thing. So the idea, I think, if it has a strength, it's in that it's trying to take advantage of the fact that because you've got interacting parts of the system, that things are more stable at that level and hopefully more predictable.
So if you were, I don't mean to belabor this, but I'm trying to get a grip on it. So if you were using something like total system MSY and tracking that over a period of time, then if you saw changes in it, would that be something that you could use as a benchmark to the health of the ecosystem?
That's a good point because, in fact, the way we're conceiving this, you would want it to be a dynamic concept. One of the things about and one of the reasons I favor taking it from the bottom up is that you can get differences over time in terms of the amount of primary production that relate to the amount of nutrients coming in. And as it turns out, in our area, the amount of the influence of Labrador slope water is a big determinant of that. If there's a lot of Labrador slope water coming down to us, it's lower productivity. So you can't, if I've got your question right, you can and should actually adjust these calculations for changes in the amount coming in that way. So you could make it dynamic or adaptive in that sense. So going back to one of the principles we established for what we want to do in the ecosystem approach. We'd want to build that in, and that could be a pretty important part of it. So we do want to conceive of it as being responsive to changes in the system of different types, and environmental or climate forcing would certainly want to be one of the important ones, but also other changes that come into play on the biological side that you could also bring into account.
Okay, I'm going to take a couple more questions and then take a five-minute break before the next presentation. Phil, did you have your hand up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mike. It's quite an undertaking, I guess. Well, I'm sure, actually. What I'm confused with a little bit is the time frame that you look at doing this. I mean, I see it related a lot to the survey, so it's in the 60s. Are we looking from there, or are you looking back to the early? Because a lot of the stocks and the science goes back into the 20s, 10s and 20s, and I'm kind of curious of what kind of time frame we look at in this whole picture of this thing and how you account for that.
Yeah, that's a good point, Phil, because there is a lot of concern that, things have shifted enough that what we're looking at has obviously been affected by, in our case here, centuries, in Georgia, centuries of harvesting. There's two things about it. One, the databases that we have in order to try to determine the things that go into some of those box models I showed you do principally come back to the time period over the last just over 40 years now from the trawl surveys and other sources of information. So the database that we have to work with goes back that far but not further. In terms of this idea of trying to track things from the bottom up, which is, say, the amount of primary production over time. Basically, we're relying on information that's either coming now from satellites or before work we did on ships that go back into the 70s. We don't have evidence from other sources that there has been, say, long-term trends in the amount of primary production that would affect the kind of calculation that I'm talking about. Now. So I think what I would say in answer is that probably to a pretty large degree, at least to the extent that we can deal with the making inferences from the last 40 years, that we've definitely seen a lot of changes in the players in the system or in their relative amounts, but basically it's mostly been overall much more stable in terms of the overall productivity during that time period. And, in fact, when you do these energy calculations, you find that, for example, everything couldn't have been 10 or 20 times higher. There's just not enough energy to get to that level. So things we're seeing what appears to be, at least to the extent that we can deal with, draw inferences from these last 40 more or more years, is that things have been relatively stable, but the players have changed in their relative importance over time. Does that get at what you're trying to?
Yeah, part of it. I mean, my concern comes, Mike, is if we're only looking at 40 years and trying to do it in this type of look at it,
yeah,
to me, ends up a little short-sighted. When we had a collapse, and history demonstrates there was a collapse in the late 1800s, early 1900s, which I'm pretty sure we can't blame on the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this meteorological data and all of that that could be coincided with it, and I'm not sure how that mm-hmm. plays in. In my mind, the 40 years is a great start, but what happened post that is still a big puzzle, and it needs to be part of it.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to go about it without, I realize there's a data restriction, but there's also quite a bit there that it might not be the data the Science Center really likes to use, but there's quite a bit of historical data out there that demonstrates that I feel should be incorporated in part of it, and that's my concern.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. I mean, we'll definitely try to incorporate everything we can in this. I guess another way to try to deal with that concern, though, too, Phil, is that the other part of the story that I had a bit of a chance to talk about last time when I came before the council is this idea of using indicators to track changes over time, say, starting in the present, to keep our finger on the pulse of what's going. So I think part of what you're saying is that there are these changes that have occurred for a lot of different reasons. Some of them are related to natural factors. And then that last presentation, I talked about some of those changes that, for example, we've had in some of the large-scale atmospheric forcing that affects the oceanography of our area. But what we definitely do need to know is keep our finger on the pulse of all the changes at a number of different factors, ranging from the physical oceanography and atmospheric conditions all the way through, so that if we see changes in some of those that appear to then to be related to changes in the fish that we're interested in, we'd be in a position to connect the dots. So we are planning for a kind of a safety valve that I think might allay some of the concerns, even though we don't have the full temporal perspective, or historical perspective that you might like to see. We can do things to guard against, tracking, guard against coming to the wrong conclusions about what's causing changes in the system.
Okay, one more. Dave?
Yeah, I wonder how instructive all this might be to nutrient management in our estuaries and mm-hmm. the types of nutrients, the numbers, because the quite a few members of the public were already looking at what we're doing in Long Island Sound, for example, and saying we've removed too many nutrients, we're starving the fish and so forth. Uh-huh. And I wonder how far out, into the ocean we can carry that.
Yeah. I think, Dave, part of it's reflected in some of the satellite images I showed where you actually can see the influence from the terrestrial part of the system. Even absent humans putting in fertilizer and so forth, we would still see that pattern anyways because of the natural runoff patterns. And basically, it turns out that when you get out on the continental shelf, the thing that really fuels things is the nitrogen. If you're worried about a freshwater system, you're probably a little bit more worried about phosphorus than nitrogen. But the thing that really drives these plankton blooms is how much nitrogen is getting into the water. And so we do need to keep track of that and try and understand what the roles of human inputs would be to that, coming from things like fertilizers and other sources. One of the real concerns, of course, is that if there's too much loading of nutrients into the system, then, as you know, we get these anoxic conditions that when you have a bloom of the phytoplankton, then they die and go down to the bottom. And, of course, you've grappled with that in Long Island Sound. So it is a pretty serious concern overall.
Okay, thanks, Mike. We're going to take a five-minute break, and then we'll jump into the next presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.